Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to Fire Engineering Talk Radio. Each week, our host will introduce you to a various cast of characters you will only find here. Each host will share experience, knowledge, and expertise regarding their years in the fire service, allowing you to call in and speak with them live, an experience you can only find on Fire Engineering Talk Radio. So thanks for joining us. Enjoy and stay safe.
Hello. Hello, everybody. It's February 14th, Valentine's Day, and you're listening to us on Blog Talk Radio, which we're glad to have you all on here. Mark, do we got you on here live?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Awesome. So, well, how are things down there in Western Kentucky, Mark?
Right now, the weather is above freezing, has been for the majority of the afternoon. We have some very slick spots out there where the water is floating on top of the ice, expected to go down below freezing sometime this evening and stay there for the rest of the night, but we have had none of the snow yet that they're predicting.
Well, that's good. That's good. You guys been busy with the any runs today with the weather-related runs?
No, not in my department. There have been a few around. Had a house fire this morning about 30 minutes north of us, but nothing right here close.
Awesome. Well, folks, I think we got a pretty good show on tonight. If you've been following us on the Facebook page, which it's Small Town Tactics and Tools, just like the show name suggests. And Jim's out tonight. He's out for Valentine's Day, and basically it's going to be me and Mark, and Mike may join in here. He's on duty tonight. We got a few others who may end up calling in if night stays slow for them. But in case you haven't been following, tonight's going to be a training topic night. And if you remember from last week's show, we got into death by PowerPoint and all the different aspects of training within these rural and suburban departments. And I think tonight we're going to hit on that some more. And, Mark, let's go ahead and get into this then. And I know we was talking with you about the death by PowerPoint and how you feel about that. What kind of stuff have you seen, you know, I know it gets your blood boiling how some instructors just sit there and go word for word. And I know Paul Combs had the painting about the death by PowerPoint. You know, what's your background with an experience about seeing young instructors take off with the death by PowerPoint?
Well, I mean, it seems that we use it too much as a crutch. It's too easy to sit in a classroom a lot of times. And don't get me wrong, there are a lot of times when a PowerPoint presentation is the only way that you're going to get training in at a particular department. But you have to remember that we need to be functional in what we're teaching before we go out there and try to present it to the general public. And my dad used to tease me about a saying that said, those who can do and those who can't teach. Well, in the fire service, the really good instructors are the ones who can do both. They can take that information that they've learned over years and years of experience and then convey it to a younger group of students, maybe coming on in the fire service, way that does a couple of things. The first one is you want to teach them the safe and proper way to conduct fire scene grounds operations, and you want to teach them the important things from the ground up about the adversary that they're going to be out there fighting. But to sit in a classroom and read to them without that practical knowledge, I might as well just Xerox the PowerPoints, hand them out, and we could all go home and read them in the comfort of our living room. If they can't functionally learn how to take that information that's in the PowerPoint and practically apply it at 2:30 in the morning when everything's going south around them, we've done absolutely no good through the training. I had a training class last night that was your PowerPoint was about the only thing we could do with the weather and everything else that was here. It was fire prevention and public education. Kind of hard to do a lot of that in the practical application part. So what we did is we actually went around the fire department and we spent a little bit of time looking for things there that needed to be changed, upgraded, just so that we're not sitting in a seat staring at a screen.
Right, and that's, I'll tell you, it, you know, and that brings up a good point because, you know, you and I both come from, you know, some of the more rural and the more poor areas. So, you know, we don't always have the state-of-the-art training centers. And, you know, and I see a lot of times, and I know we talked about this on the last show, but, you know, a lot of these younger guys, and just not only them, but the older guys too, you start throwing them into PowerPoints, you know, where it's, as I'll tell you, the cookie cutters, you know. I mean, and we're not going to get into different manufacturers, but there's some out there that are so dry that it's hard to get anybody involved and anybody interested in them. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen that I like is when instructors can take the topic and then make it their own, so to speak. They can take it and make their own PowerPoints on it. And so, you know, you're not getting a cookie cutter feel. And, you know, and just like with the PowerPoint or with the public education, you know, you was talking about, you know, that's a great example because all too often, how many times have we seen where somebody will sit there and take a PowerPoint? And, you know, some people, you know, there's several different ways to learn. And, you know, some people are good with visualizing it so they can sit down and read a book, boom, done. Some have to hear it audio, you know, style. So you tell them and they can retain it. And some get into hands-on. And that tends to be how I am. I can read the stuff. If I can't do it with my hands or visualize it, it's hard for me to retain it. And when you start dealing with a lot of PowerPoints and you know, not only but PubEd, but like Hazmat too, it gets hard to start retaining this stuff the way we need to. And you know, have you seen a lot of people making their own PowerPoints or instructors that are making their own PowerPoints within the state here or within other rural areas? Because I know you're teaching here at the Bryant Style School. And, you know, are you guys creating your own PowerPoints or are you all going with like a cookie cutter method? Okay. So I guess, you know, just to, I guess, cue on this, what we also do is we will go and take a PowerPoint, if you will, and then let's say we're doing fire behavior. And if we're taking fire behavior, so you can sit there and you can see, okay, this is flashover. So it'll give you the definition, you'll see it, yada, yada, yada. But then where you can really take and put this into perspective is pull up YouTube. And then when you pull up YouTube, there's tons of videos of flash cams and, you know, just spectators filming things and buffs filming things. And you can show them. And you can get more involved with that. And so they're like, oh, okay, yeah, I've seen that before on a fire ground. And so it starts to really click in. And, you know, it really goes over very well. And I think the more inclusion you can get within these and the more, I guess you could say, interaction you're getting with the students, the better off you are. And I think for the most part in these rural areas and suburban areas, that's going to be the better way to start also getting into retaining volunteers because they're not going to want to show up and spend their time being talked to. They're going to want to be involved with stuff. So, you know, but again, you know, Mark, are you guys teaching at the Bryant Style School this year? Are you guys going with a cookie cutter style PowerPoint? Or are you guys making your own or do you see many instructors making their own on the state level and within these departmental levels that you're going to?
Well, remember that a good portion of what's taught at the Bryant Stiles Officer School in Lexington, and again, and it will be next year back into Owensboro, a lot of those are classes and curriculums that they have not specifically been cookie-cutter produced at this point. A lot of them, the one that we're teaching is a class that the fire marshal, or one of the fire marshals here in Western Kentucky and myself have put together. It's kind of an advanced look at arson after the first initial call and the fire department's role in that. Well, there's not a follow-through class for that. The IAA does a fantastic job of putting on the arson 1, 2, and 3 classes here in Kentucky. And as far as the scene investigation and the courtroom testimony, they do a beautiful job of handling that. The problem is a lot of times the small departments in this area feel kind of lost in the shuffle, not knowing what's going on in the investigation around them once it's turned over to local authorities or state authorities. And this is just kind of a follow-up on a previous class that we had where they're going to be able to participate a little bit more in the investigation, follow through and understand the process that's going on around them through the judicial system. Well, by doing that, there's not any curriculum that we were able to find right out of the box that we were able to teach. So we've had to customize a lot of that. And what you were saying makes fantastic sense. The thing is, you can only do those PowerPoint presentations. You can only make them on things that you're comfortable with, things that you had experience with, things you're following a set of guidelines with. I would never step out into, even though I've had experience in the public sector in the area of prosecution, I would never step into specifically teaching a class on prosecution. That's no longer my area of expertise. So you really want to make sure that when those instructors are building those custom PowerPoint presentations that they're working through areas that they're familiar with, and they are staying with state, local, and federal guidelines if they're going to be working on them.
Right, and, you know, and that brings up a good point, because I know how often have we all seen it where, you know, you'll get an instructor who will come in and will start teaching something, and then you get a student who asks questions, so to speak, and the instructor is left puzzled, and they don't know what they're talking about, they don't know what they're looking at, and, you know, it makes the class, it takes, I guess, the life energy out of that class, and you just, it's like, ugh, I don't want to be there anymore, and, you know, it happens. And even with the cookie cutter, I mean, it shows. When they don't know what they're talking about, it shows very quick. You know what I mean? And I totally get that, and I totally agree with that message that, you know, if you don't know what you're talking about, you probably shouldn't be teaching on it. Now, you know, with that in mind, you know, and we'll get off topic here a little bit, but, you know, as far as the credentialing to become an instructor, you know, what are your thoughts on knowing certain topics versus being able to, okay, so you're a firefighter one, firefighter two, you know, you take a course and boom, now you're able to, do you think that's an adequate, I guess you could say, way to get your instructor's permit, or do you think there needs to be more?
I have no problem with that being a beginning stage. I think that one of the things that we're very fortunate about in Western Kentucky is you're going to get plenty of adequate feedback from the fire departments, and if you go into the fire departments and do a lousy job, they're probably just not going to request you back, and I have absolutely no problem with that whatsoever. A lot of the chiefs in this area have a really good foundation of really good instruction, and they have no problem if an instructor is trying to come along and learn, which we have a lot of that. They will mentor a young instructor and bring him up and help make him an exceptional instructor. They will assist him in planning, scheduling, getting the classes ready that are good for their department, and then allow him to fall on his face two or three times, make those mistakes, and continue to encourage him. So I think it has to be a joint effort where we are we're able to monitor those instructors after they get their certification. We're able to help them grow. And unfortunately, I don't think the system is designed as much to do that as the service is. And I think that that's something that we have to allow the discretion of the senior instructors, which I'm not one of. There's a lot of fantastic instructors in Western Kentucky. I'm just a guy with a shovel. The area coordinators in state fire rescue training throughout Kentucky do a beautiful job of screening and deciding who can work for state fire and rescue based on their experience, and then they will take them and put them in with senior instructors in Western Kentucky to go out and learn trade, get their feet wet, and kind of get the excitement.
Right. So do we have any callers on the air with us?
I do. Just a moment, and I will bring him on board.
Awesome.
Can you hear me, Julio?
Yes, I can hear you. How are you guys doing today?
Julio, what are you into, buddy?
How are you, brother? I'm good.
I'm good. So how's Florida tonight?
Well, like I was telling Mark, it's a little bit cool. We're in the high 50s. We end up having a 20-acre brush fire throwing some homes, and I end up going to someone's couple of people's backyards. But the companies I'm seeing made a good stop, and now the fire is contained. Forestry came, plowed some lines, and we're just going to be watching it throughout the night. I've been talking to Chris for a while, and we've been talking about rural tactics. Obviously, when people hear Orlando, Florida, they think, oh, Disney World and, you know, all cities, high-rises. Believe it or not, about 30% of Orlando has no hydrants in its areas. If you start listening, if you ever Google Biflo or Christmas, Florida, that's in Orange County, that's where I work at, there's not a hydrant in about a six-mile radius in that area. So it's actually a good topic, and I wanted to listen to what you guys think about tactics and strategies and all that also. So,
yeah.
Here I am.
That's a good topic, and Mark, I know you're really passionate about good water supply and tanker shuttles. And now, Julio, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys got a few tankers down there in those rural areas, correct? That are staffed.
Well, there's six tankers in the county. Three out of the six are staffed. The other three, they're at stations that they have a four-man on the engine, and then the fourth man, there's a big fire that they're requiring a tanker. Fourth man to jump off the engine and drive the tanker to wherever it's needed at. What Orange County has done in these areas, especially in rural areas, number one, all of our engines in Orange County, for the exception of two, are 750 gallons of water. They also have a 25-gallon Class A knockdown foam system on board, surfactants, if you will, to help, you know, with water penetration and conservancy of water. And like I said, our tankers are 3,500 gallons each. So that's how we, you know, kind of get away with not having that many tankers.
Right.
Plus, like those areas, like when I used to work in the 6th Battalion, all those stations out there had a Woods truck. Now, a Woods truck, just think of a newer version of the military 6x6s. So these are from Freightliner. Freightliner, a couple years ago, made these huge trucks. They also carried 750 gallons of water. They had a pump in the back, so they were able to go off-road. I mean, we were able to go over 2 feet worth of logs and trees that are off the ground. And then those trucks, a lot of lieutenants came up with the idea saying, hey, that tanker is only 55 miles an hour that it drives. We need something fast. We're going to take the brush truck or the wood truck with us to give us that extra 750 gallons of water. Now we got 1,500 gallons of water on scene initially in the first 5 minutes. Then the next engine comes, gives us their 750 gallons of water, and the tanker comes and drops to 3,500 gallons. So we're talking about 6,000 gallons within the first 15, 20 minutes. That's not bad if I say so.
No, that's pretty good.
You know, but that does take thinking on their part. You know, not everybody agrees with that tactics. You know, like every department, people are going to agree and disagree about certain tactics. Especially some of those stations, like everybody else is suffering through budget cuts and whatnot. We've been going on a three-man engine, so that means that the engineer and the lieutenant are on the engine, that firefighter's on the Woods truck. And it just takes a lot of planning and a lot of drilling on their part to get comfortable doing that. Because also, the Woods truck, there's no computer. There's not nobody else to help you to navigate. You got a map book, and a GPS and cell phones. And Christmas and Biflo and Westfield, Florida, they tend to have a lot of no-name roads, a lot of dirt roads. Houses tend to be 1,000 feet off the driveway, in a dirt driveway, which goes back in people pre-planning their areas, walking out in their first new areas and taking out those trucks and practicing these long days and practicing driving those terrains. So,
right.
But good
let me ask you,
that way.
Yeah, let me ask you, Hoyt. Do you guys do a lot with the like a pumper relay, where you know you've got really tight, narrow driveways or roads where instead of doing having the tanker back a mile down the road, you just relay pump out down that narrow lane. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Do you guys do
yes,
with that?
Yes, we do a lot of relay pumping. We also do a lot of split lanes where, like I say, the first in engine or the first in wood truck would drop 3 or 5 inch lines. Preferably, typically, we'll drop a 3 inch line on these rural areas and then have companies come hand jack another 3 inch or another 5 inch line. But that first engine or wood truck that gets to the driveway, drop a 3 inch line and start heading out. And then the first engine or the second dual engine will park outside. And then that tanker will do port a tank operation, drop its tank, and then the tanker go out into the main roadway and start filling up with water. We'll also have an engine at a pond or a hydrant nearby to help fill up the tankers faster, if you will. We do practice a lot of relay pumping. Even in the urban areas, our SOP state, even in the urban areas, if we have a hydrant, every 600 feet, we'll try to have an engine in the middle to relay, continuing relaying the hydrant, if you will.
Right. You said that you've got hydrants about every how many feet, sir?
No. Let's say if I catch a hydrant and the lay is going to be like a 1,200 foot lay, even in the urban areas in our city, in our county. If we have to lay more than 600 to 1,000 feet of holes, we're going to put an engine in the middle of that and then continue on laying that so we can relay.
Okay.
But most of inside the city areas, almost every block has a hydrant. I mean, we've had, like in my first two, we have a couple of 1,300 foot lays. That's about as
yes,
much
sir.
As we're going to get. But we normally have about a 200-300 foot lay for the most part. In the rural areas, There's no lane for a hydrant. There's tankers.
Yes, sir. Water
right.
shuttle. And on average, how far would it be? How far would a water shuttle be for you guys? A 1 mile, mile and a half?
Depends more specifically. Christmas, Florida, they have one hydrant. It's not even a hydrant. It's a... like someone's a well that they built for fire protection, and it's a 3-inch. It's a dry hydrant with a 3-inch connection, and we have 3-inch suction for that engine to hook up there. That may be 4 miles away from the furthest in the first two. But we also think outside the box. We have the turbo draft, if anybody ever heard of that. You can put that on a pool or in the water up to 300 feet away from your source. You can drop a 5-inch line. At a 3-inch line, you pump the 3-inch line into the turbo draft where it's in the pond or the pool, and it creates a venturi effect and it suctions out water back to the 5-inch line. Typically, we get about 700 gallons per minute on that turbo draft.
Excellent.
So we've used, and we also got portable pumps where we go out to narrow creeks and pools. Think about most residential pools here carry about 5,000, 6,000 gallons of water. There's an area in Orange County called Moss Park. What they did, they have a retention pond. There's no hydrant for like 8 miles in that area. What they did, they have a dry hydrant, and then they also have a fire department connection. The first in engine or second in engine would stop at that retention pond where that hydrant is at, draft out of that hydrant, and then pump that FDC. Now, that FDC has a grid, and it has, like, 3-inch pipes or 3-inch hydrants, per se, around that neighborhood. So that engine is pumping, like, 3-4 square block grid. And then if it's in the back end of the neighborhood, there's a 3-inch hydrant out there that they can connect to and catch water that way. But that was the the community's part of themselves so they can have, you know, lower the insurance. They came up with a plan. Some fire engineers, some fire protection specialists came and came with that system where, okay, hey, we got this retention pond. We can use it to our advantage. It's just going to require the fire department to pump it, to draft it and pump that water into the system to get a water supply if you get a fire down the neighborhood.
Excellent. When did they put that in, Julio?
It's within the last, I'm actually going to say the last 7 years, seven, 8 years.
Okay. Do you guys do quite a bit of training on that? Because that is an ingenious way to do it. Do you guys do combined training with other departments in the area to get proficient at that?
Yes.
Stay active with it?
Yes.
That's excellent, sir.
Yes. Actually, that's that particular neighborhood belongs to Orange County, but second and third due units are coming from the city of Orlando. Their pumps are configured differently. We carry 5-inch hose. They carry 4-inch hose. We carry draft lines. They do not. So we train extensively with them. We do it once or twice a year, and we even made it to a multi-company drill where everybody in the department has come out and trained and using it. But once a year for the units I'm seeing around there in Orlando, and then once every 2 years as a multi-company drill for the whole department. So, yeah, we do a lot
that
of
is really
and
good.
Then, yeah, and then, of course, the company officers that are out there, they do it more often than obviously the rest of the department do. Like I know a good friend of mine, he's a lieutenant out there. He's on his way out. He's close to retiring. But every time a new guy or someone works overtime or a firefighter that can ride out of class as an engineer goes to drive the engine for the day, he'll take him out there and get the tanker out there, and they'll train on it. So he says, hey, if we get a fire, this is what we're going to be doing. So some people train more than others, like anybody else.
Yes,
right,
but
it sounds
like that goes back to what we were talking about before, Julio. And I'll brag on your lieutenant a little bit. It sounds like even though he may be on his way out, he's taking the information that he has learned and what you guys have perfected, and he's making sure that all of the newer guys coming along learn it firsthand from an expert, and they don't take it for granted that, ah, these guys will catch on. They're really, it sounds like he's going out and teaching it. That's a testament to a good officer there, sir.
Yeah, well, he was also... Like, if you guys ever know about special operations, he was in the special operations program for over 20 years. You know, he got out of it because he was already ready to retire, but he still has that mentality, that can-do mentality. That, and also, that pursuit has million-dollar homes, so it is wise of him to train people, because burning down a million-dollar home, that's going to make the news, and it's not going to look good for Orange County.
That's a fact.
So, yeah, it's like we talked about with the instructors and the training tonight. You know, one of the things that I think that happens a lot that I see is a lot of people think that you have to have an instructor number or you have to be recognized by a state or a county or the department as a training official. You know, you can be Joe Schmo on the department and teach somebody something, and. You know, even if it's not a PowerPoint presentation, just to share your info like your Lieutenant Julio, you know, that stuff is invaluable. And, you know, it's stuff like that that can do more than any PowerPoint. And you know, and that's just great, you know.
It is. You guys brought up a good point about being instructors. Here in the state of Florida, obviously to teach you have to have your Instructor 1, Instructor 2, Instructor 3. You know, it depends how many certifications and degrees you have. But in reality, an instructor certification, it's only meant if you're going to be teaching a class that people could be paying for. It's more for liability purposes. Yes, you know, it is nice if your lieutenants can become state-certified instructors. So in case something goes wrong during training, there's some backing to it. But when you're doing informal training, when you're doing company drill training or even multi-company drill training, when your battalion chief or district chief says, hey, we're going to get a couple units out, we're just going to practice relay pumping, you don't need an instructor for that. You do need to have objectives. You need to have goals. You need to have people with the right attitudes, the can-do attitude, not there to you know, fumble around and mess around and host play around. When we're training, you got to have the mindset of, hey, this is the real deal. We're not just worrying about time. We're worrying about professionalism. We're worrying about getting the job done. And it's true. Anybody can teach. You know, even our probationary firefighters that have a skill off duty, you know, there's a lot of welders. And, Chris, you can chime in on that because you've been teaching how to weld throughout the phone. And you live in Kentucky.
yeah.
So,
yeah.
You don't need a certification to teach. You only need it when it's for a standard, when you're going to be teaching something that people are going to be paying for. But if you got a little piece of information that can save someone's life, it'll be stupid of the person not to pass that information, all because I'm not an instructor. That doesn't work that
Amen.
Way, not in the fire service.
Amen.
You know, I was blessed this year, and it came through an unfortunate event. You know, I had to go to light duty for a while, and that's when I got exposed to teaching and training, and I got to teach the last recruit class. I was just invited to go full-time to teach the next recruit class that we're hiring. I'm no instructor by no means, but these people know that I have a passion for training and a determination and a willingness to see people better themselves, just like I have people pushing me to my limits and pushing me to better myself. Of course, we do have state instructors at training, and, you know, I'll be the logistics person, but, like, any little informal training that we do at training, that's something that's going to be able to chime on and help these people out when they come on the field. Like, one thing, and I think everybody can agree with this, there's a big gap between training and the real world. And what I've been trying to get across is that we need to bridge that gap between training and the real world. Train on real-world tactics. Train on those rural tactics, not how we do because of an NFPA standard. They're there as a standard. They're not there to dictate exactly word for word what we're going to be doing on team.
Exactly. Yeah. Julio, I am going to ask you to think about something, and we're going to take a quick break here.
Yeah.
I want to kind of expand on that with Chris in just a second. When we get back, we're going to pay the bills real quick and say I'm going to put you guys, let you talk to bed as soon as we come back. Hold tight for just a minute, gentlemen.
The 4,600-page Granger Catalog. Every solution on earth for every problem under the sun. And now, it fits in your pocket. Download the app today. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Granger.com, or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, gentlemen, welcome back. We want to make sure that we take time throughout the show to thank Granger for making all of this available to us and giving us the ability to be on here tonight, field questions, and kind of give our opinions. My goal in this, and I know Chris feels the same way, is to throw stuff out there and then let's kick it around and get some input on it, because that's the way we're all going to learn and make sure that we do a better job. One of the things that, and Julio, it sounds like you've got kind of a unique perspective if you've been in it for a short time recently just because of your situation. Tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing in Orlando with the training. Do you guys have a set academy for the paid guys down there that the volunteers have access to? And Chris, I'm going to let you follow up on that.
Yes, in the state of Florida, we have designated training academies for our department ourselves. We have a specific training academy for our needs, but we invite firefighters from all over the state to come train with us, or vice versa. We come train with them. And then our same thing, we have a local college that has a training academy, and they themselves let us utilize it because we're part of the consortium with all the surrounding departments to use it. Does that make sense? Like, in Orlando, there's one specific school, and the six surrounding departments, they use that academy. We just put it on a master events calendar, hey, when we're going to use it, and then it gets on the calendar, and we use it. So,
cool.
Lately, we've been having the multi-company drills. We've been doing the live fire training, and we've actually had departments from throughout our neighboring departments. They come out and do the live fire training with us, specifically our mutual aid departments. So,
cool.
And that brings up something else that I would really like to kind of kick out there and let you guys throw in some ideas and some input and see if we can't figure out a better way to do it. I sat down and talked to an area coordinator who happens to be one of my very closest friends in the world this week, and one of the observations that he brought up, he schedules training for 60-plus departments and farms out instructors to those departments to ensure that they get what they need throughout the year. And it seems like a lot of the departments are requesting fire instruction for some of the advanced subjects, your live fire training, some of the hands-on drills, things like that. And when they get on scene, they haven't had the basic training on setting the ladder. And so although they've had some of the live fire training, they're not scared to go in. They've got a pretty good grasp on fire behavior. It seems like it sometimes looks like the Three Stooges on the fire scene when it comes to doing some of those basic operations. And I'm going to shut up for a minute and just let you, Chris, Leo, kind of chime in as far as your observations and then anything that you can do or think of that would help us streamline that, help us make sure that we go through the basics, because we have people starting at, you know, you may have one guy start in a small volunteer department in January. You get him about halfway trained, and two more guys start in April. And how do you handle those issues?
So basically, what we do up here in Northern Kentucky is, you know, again, and I think a lot of this falls back on the death by PowerPoint. You know, you can take the basics, and yes, I think everybody needs to know the parts of a ladder, how the ladder is made, the NFPA standards. But at the same sense, you also need to know how to throw the ladder. You need to know where to throw it, when to throw it. You know, your positions of throwing it. You know, is it going to be used for just entry and exit, or is it going to be more for a emergency egress? You know, and all these different things come around, and you know, a lot of times there are the PowerPoints that don't show this stuff. They don't show it. And so one of the things that we have done at our company, just for company drills, is, you know, we'll just take a ladder off, and instead of going over, you know, your heat sensors and this and that, you know, okay, here's the building, how do you ladder it? Where are we going to put our ladders? What is the best way to do this? You know, and then, you know, a lot of people see PG County and Boston, and they see all these ladders, and, you know, it just goes to show, you know, not only but the ladders, but there's ways to do things, you know, and you've got to get into that mindset. So, you know, some of the other things we'll do is we've got new guys coming on with, you know, let's just say fire attack. You know, they want to get into more advanced stuff. And, you know, and that's great. You know, once you've got the basics, and you know, everything to me, advanced stuff is also basic stuff. So let's talk about that. That to me, when I've got new guys and they're like, "Let's learn fire attack." Okay, great. You want to learn fire attack? Well, when we start looking at fire attack and moving hand line, what's the number one thing you start seeing? Well, how do you handle a hand line? Okay, well, that's basic stuff. But then we get into the more advanced stuff on making the move, making the push, doing all that. That's considered advanced to some people, but it's still a basic skill, because when you look at it, it's something that if you don't do it right, you're going to lose a building. That's not, to me, advanced stuff is your high angle, your low angle, your hazmat, stuff like that. And that's all well and good, but at the same time, if you can't put out a fire, you know, then how can you? You're more of a technical rescue team than you are a fire department. And so when we look at this, the basics is everything, even if it's advanced. So the basics to me on, let's say, fire attack, okay, the direct, indirect combination, okay, that's going to be super basic, okay? That's your groundwork. And then you're going to build up from there on how to make the push, how to coordinate. And, you know, if you don't have six dudes on a fire engine, you know, you're going to have to figure out how to work it. with your staffing levels. And so how many times, Mark, have you seen and out here in rural Kentucky where you'll have a guy moving a hand line and there's a dude right on his back and he's got a hand on his back and he's boot to boot with the dude and they just walk forward in the parking lot, spraying water or whatnot. If you do that in a house, you're going to have problems. You know, one, you're going to end up with a ton of, friction going around corners and stuff. So, you know, you got to start getting into realistic stuff. And one of the things that I've found is, again, playgrounds. You know, you take your dudes, you go out to the playground, you stretch your line through the playground equipment. You know, you can flow water on it. You can do all kinds of stuff. I mean, let's face it. Kids puke on it. You know, it stands up to the weather. You're not going to hurt it. And it gets you a real good sense of making tight corners, moving on your hands and knees if you have to, or the way you should, and sounding the floor out because, you know, it's not a solid in some spots. You can stick your leg up under a stair or something like that on things. But there's rails on the side so you don't have to worry about falling off and stuff. And it's really good to teach so-called advanced stuff, which is actually just the basics. And now some of the other things, and you was talking about with the academies, you know, each area, like up here we've got a Kenton County recruit class, which is a fire academy. And when you come out of there, you got your 150, and you're all set to get your FSAC 1. And it's a great program, and it's helping a lot of the rural departments to catch up, and once they graduate their brand-new recruit, he's up to par. So it gives you your 20 hours that the state requires and then some. And it's good solid training by good solid instructors. And there's live burns, there's hazmat in there. You know, it gives you the 150. And like I said, and it preps you for your FSAC 1. So it's a really good program. Now, Julio, on to you. I know you guys use a lot of reserve firefighters. So how does your all's training program work with the reserves?
Okay, well, for one thing, in the state of Florida has a very stringent law concerning, you know, firefighting. In order to apply in a fire department, you have to have your minimum standards, which is 480 hours worth of training. You have to have your firefighter 1 and firefighter 2. Now, for volunteer departments, all that is required is your firefighter 1, which is 240 hours worth of training. In the firefighter 1, most volunteer departments, they have a couple instructors that work for the department. They can teach a firefighter 1 within the department. But if they want to advance to a career department or they want to advance to firefighter 2, they have to go to a state-accredited school, like the State Fire College, or like in my city, we have a accredited college that can teach your minimum standards. That's a big thing. So firefighters already come in the department already having basic, you know, knowledge in firefighting, hazard materials, and first response. Once they get hired or once they get into a volunteer department, then that department themselves will also teach them the way they do things, like a recruit orientation. Same thing with our reserves. Like our reserves, they had it in Orange County. We required them that they had their minimum standards training and their EMT training. Most of the time, the reason why I say that is because most of the time when we start hiring, we usually pull out of our reserves first. Our reserves are usually the first ones to get hired as career and then the applicants. So those firefighters, they have to have the same certification as a career guy, and they also get like a 1 week, 2 week orientation that start riding. And if we hire them, then they have to go to a 6 week orientation where we teach them how Orange County does things. So that's pretty much the standard throughout the state of Florida.
Cool. That's good. And, you know, now, Mark, let me ask you the same question then, you know, and let's reverse the question back at you. You know, with your area that you teach for, the area of, you know, I guess that's 2, you know, what are you guys doing as far as a regional fire school or a regional recruit class?
You asking me in Western Kentucky, Chris?
Correct.
Okay, we don't necessarily have access to the local 240-hour standalone school. We've had a couple of departments that have gotten regional grants that have put on the basic 240 and 400-hour firefighter class to prepare for Firefighter 1 and 2 testing over the past couple of years. That's worked pretty well depending on the coordination between the instructors. That was two nights a week for the better part of the summer. And so as long as the instructors coordinated and followed through on specific teaching, they had really good results doing that. But we don't have a standalone classroom. The way our system is tied in here in Western Kentucky is the regions have fire science degree programs set up through the colleges locally, and they bring in very, very good competent instructors to teach those. When they're done, they graduate with an associate's degree, and they're ready to take that Firefighter 1 and 2 test. It works out very well. They have a tremendous placement record in Western Kentucky with the degree program in paid fire departments, as well as developing really good, solid volunteers. However, if I just wanted to join a volunteer department like I did 29 years ago, basically the only training that I'm required to have is the standard 20 hours of initial training, and then I'm able to make runs. So, again, it goes back to, I'm not Firefighter 1 and 2 certified at that point, but it goes back to, just like we were talking about last week, and having the individual officers and the incident commanders on charge in scene, knowing who's capable, who's competent, and relying on that interaction between the individual firefighter who should say, okay, I've only got my initial 20 hours, and no, I'm not going to be comfortable or competent making that interior attack because we're not quite as organized in upfront training as some areas are. Sounds like Florida has it down to a science, and that's fantastic. If we did go with the you have to go to class for 240 hours before you're able to ride the truck and make runs, it would be very, very hard with the work situation in Western Kentucky. We have jobs, but you know, a lot of people scrambling to keep food on the table with their family. So we would probably lose a lot of good firefighter candidates if we were much stricter on our policy. But on the same token, that puts a lot of responsibility on the company officer to ensure that he's working for safety and everything else on the fire scene.
Well,
on that same note, Chris, we do have some extremely good regional schools here. Every area in Western Kentucky has at least one annual three-day regional school where you can sign up for sometimes as many as 20 to 25 individual classes. Take your pick for what you need in order to expand your expertise from basic 20 hours up to very, very advanced classes and bring in expert teachers on each subject. And so we've been able to kind of customize our training there to fit the community and what they're able to do.
Awesome. And, you know, you bring up company officers and the responsibility that they have with the new guys. And, you know, and I know the way Julio will probably tell us, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, also down there, if you've got your probie, he's going to fall under your company officer. And, you know, when you start dealing with the volunteer fire companies, you know, it starts to put a lot of, I guess to be a good volunteer fire officer, he knows his people. So let's say you go to run at 3 a.m. and you look in the back of your rig at who shows up for a house fire. You can look at each one of your dudes or females, or dudettes, I guess you could say, and, you know, he'll know, okay, well, there's John. You know, John is good at forcible entry. He's great. Oh, I got a new guy. He's brand new, never caught a fire. He's got his basics in. Okay, great. I can put him with John, and he'll learn good. You know, I got Sally. Sally's good at fire attack. You know, you can look back and see who you got and know what they can do. And, I mean, for the most part, are you seeing that that's being done in Western Kentucky? Because it seems to me like, you know, as a whole, some of our volunteer officers, you know, we're starting to get away from the good company officer's outlook. They get the white helmet, they get the badge, and you know, they really don't know, it seems, the full responsibilities of what all is entitled with being, you know, a lieutenant, a sergeant, a captain, you know, whatever that title may be. I mean, what are you seeing out of that? And Julio, go ahead and hit on that, because I know you guys do officer, or your reservists are also officers at times too. And, you know, and for that fact, Julio, how do they tie in with commanding a full-time crew?
Yes. Well, Orange County is unique. Even though we have reserve officers, when they ride our units in Orange County, we don't have a volunteer department. We have firefighter reserves again, so they ride in with the career guys. Now they have a couple of reserve lieutenants, reserve chiefs, but that's more for the administration of the reserve program. When they ride with us, they're still firefighters. Volunteer departments in the area or in surrounding counties. I've seen a system that they do, because Mark, I think, brought a good point talking about the whole 240 hours, how difficult it may be. Well, like I said, most volunteer departments, they teach the initial firefighter one to their candidates. They have a system where, like, it's a different helmet color or different bunker gear color that shows this person is a support, this person is an interior certified firefighter, this person is not, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing you were talking about, company officers getting away, it's not just in Kentucky. It's nationwide that fire gun officers are losing their touch. It's more to me, personally, I feel it's more because of the technology and degrees, and people are getting a sense of training more in management instead of leadership, you know. And I think more people are worrying about degrees, and advancing the corporate ladder or the fire department ladder, and not worrying about back to the basic skills, and not worrying about really what it meant to be a company officer. I think a good company officer, like you said, should know their crew. And let's say in our department, we're 1,500 strong. I don't know everybody in this department. Nobody here knows everybody in this department. I could have somebody that's been on 20 years on the job come float on my station, never know them. But it's up to my company officer to find out, hey, what are you good at, what are you not? My company officers here at my station, I'm very blessed. Every time we get a new person in or someone that floats in, we kind of test the person. We're a very busy house. We're the fifth busiest in the county. We run 20 calls a shift per unit. So we try to see where these people stand, because at the end of the day, that company officer is responsible for us, responsible for other units, and responsible for the customers that we're serving. And it's very imperative that the company officers, along with the rest of the crew, knows each other's strengths and weaknesses, and then bite off on that and help each other out.
Awesome. I agree completely, Hoop.
Huh? Oh.
All right, gentlemen, a couple of things real quick, if you don't mind. Chris, tell me what you're seeing on your new volunteers coming in. What would I expect training-wise if I signed up for your department tonight, was approved, voted on, and you said, let's go?
Well, basically what it would entail is a lot of time, I guess you could say. It would take you some time. You're going to come in, you know, you're going to get your 2 to 3 hours a week in. And then once you've got your 20 hours in, you're going to start riding a rig. And it's between 20 and 25 is essentially where they're at when they're able to start riding rigs. And so, you know, when you get a lot of these kids and, you know, and basically what that's what they are really a lot of times is they're more kids out of high school. And so we'll take them, and then once they've got their hours in, they're going to be in the topics that they need. So as you can tell from the Kentucky with the categories that you got to get, it can take you a while to get them. Now, once you've got them and you start riding on the rig, that's when a lot of your training starts to come into play, because you start getting a lot more hands-on training. So you, instead of having a quote-unquote training academy where you're doing this stuff hands-on, you're going to be doing it hands-on under live fire conditions, under the real thing. And so what that tends to end up doing is as a brand new guy, you're going to get paired up with one of the more seasoned individuals who knows what's going on. and knows basically they know their shit. And what your job is to just watch them and don't let them get hurt. And, you know, I just had one a couple weeks ago, you know, and, you know, brand new kid, brand new on the job, and you know, it was his first fire, you know. So once we basically left the line, you know, we sat back, we watched, and we talked about what was going on, and you train them. And, you know, and so it's a lot of on-the-job stuff. And, Mark, up your alley, we talked about where the fire started, and, you know, we started looking at burn patterns and the way that the fire was going and where he thought the origin of the fire was, and he nailed it. You know, he's dead on. So, you know, he's been catching on quick. And, you know, and I've seen some things we need to work on with him.
Hit a big dog, unfortunately killed him. Collar on it, no tag. So we drug him to the side of the road. A little girl crying hysterically.
I think we got some issues.
The door's open, and I don't think there's anybody home. And he doesn't want to leave this little girl crying.
That background noise from somewhere. Let me see if I can limit that.
Give me a second. Tom, stop.
You're fine.
Is that better?
So, yep, there we go.
All right. We'll come back. That was on Julio's end. We'll come back. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, he's on duty right now. So, we basically, what we'll do is we'll take it, and we saw some things to work on, you know, some air pack drills and, you know, breathing skills and stuff like that. And so you go on about that, and so, you know, basically you just keep a close eye on them. And it may sound wrong, but I like to let the new guy, I always prefer to put him on the nozzle. And
he's like, leave her standing in the front yard of Rachel.
And so basically what we'll do is we'll go and take him and put him on that nozzle, and then we'll watch. So your senior guy will be back up. And so typically what I'll do is I'll be like, okay, here, take the nozzle. Let's do what I've been telling you and teaching you. And so we'll go, and he'll start moving his nozzle around. He'll get good movement. And then you'll basically tell him exactly what to do. Okay, go ahead and shut it down. Let's let it rise. You know, let the steam rise up and out of here. And so it's a lot of hands-on. And that's the one thing I really like with our department is, you know, when you get these guys in there, you know, we have a very good respect among our new guys and our senior guys, and we all work really good together, and so it really is almost the same sense that you would find in a big urban city where the senior guy is training the new guy. We have that almost down to the same T, and so, you know, like last week, it worked really well. The kid came away with some very valuable stuff, saw some things to work on. Nobody got hurt, and it all went well. And, you know, so that's basically what our new guys would go into. And, you know, you really build a one-on-one bond with them because you're basically mentoring them. And it's almost, per se, is like a mentoring ship. You know, as a senior guy, you'll take one of these kids under your wing, at least I do, and you put it out there. Now it's up to them to take it. And as you and I both know, that sometimes within these volunteer departments in rural and suburban areas, sometimes they don't get into the job. They are here for different reasons. And you can catch on pretty quick. And, you know, let me ask you, how do you deal with it when you've got these kids coming in and they're not interested in the whole brotherhood, or they're not gung-ho about the job? They're employees, so to speak. Do you go and kick them off the department because they're a hazard, or how do you deal with them?
Well, if they're a hazard, the answer is if they're a loose cannon, then yes. But I think that we've kind of done a disservice in the fire service over the last few years. I understand that it's a brotherhood. I understand that we are a family. I think that all of the Western Kentucky departments, are very good at displaying that. However, what we end up with sometimes in Western Kentucky is, just like I said last week, a lot of guys who want to be firemen but don't want to fight fire. So by saying that, we have a lot of guys who weed themselves out because it is a lot like work. They're looking at a family atmosphere and environment, but they don't understand when they come to the department that at 2 o'clock in the morning, as soon as the fire's knocked down, we still have 1,000 foot of hose to roll up. We still have to get the truck squared away for the next house We still have gear to clean. And you kind of hit the nail on the head a minute ago, and I wanted to allude back to that and find out what Eastern or what you're doing in Northern Kentucky. And maybe we get Julio back on the line a minute ago. I lost him, and find out what they're doing in Florida. When you have a young guy show up and he is not able to devote those first two or three weekends, 3 to 4 hours at a time, as a job or family, do you take that on a case-by-case basis, or do you have a blanket policy that he has 2 weeks to get his 20 hours in, or how do you guys deal with that in your department, and what are some anybody else that wants to call in and give ideas? I'm flexible as far as listening, and I'm always looking to improve what we do out here.
Right. Basically, we take it on a case-by-case basis, you know, because sometimes the guys, they work second shift, so it's a little harder for them when they work second shift to make the trainings. So basically, we'll take it, you'll go to the chief. Usually it's a year. You've got a year to get your 150 in. And, you know, and so they stick with that basis as per code by the fire commission. And so they follow what the fire commission guidelines are set as. And so what we have is sometimes some of our instructors work second shift as well, or their schedules are more flexible. And so they will go and give the guys a training when they can get it. But other than that, you know, you almost never find one who really wants to be there who won't get the training in. And if they're wanting to be there, then they're going to find a way to make it happen. That's what we have seen. And you can tell. They're the ones who will come up to you. They'll be asking, hey, how can I get this training in? How can I get this? How can I do that? And, you know, they're not going to be the ones that you have to tell, hey, you need to get your training in. And then, you know, they'll come to you. And that's what I always like to see. You know, when they come to you, it shows, hey, he's serious. He's got an aggressiveness to him. I like that. I like that among a lot of recruits. And, you know, and I think we need to start trying to find more of those. But in the same sense, if you go and you try and alleviate everybody who's a bad apple, so to speak, sometimes, you know, you can end up with a very, very, very short roster, which puts you in a whole other perspective. You know, it creates problems there, too, when you don't have anybody. So it's a balancing act, I think, in a sense. And, you know, and so you really got to balance that out to, you know, yeah, this guy takes him a little longer to get his 20 hours in that he's needing, but, you know, he seems to be aggressive and attentive enough to find out how to get it. You know, so I don't think you can have a set standard or guideline on, okay, you've got 6 weeks to get this in, and, you know, and then boom, done, you know, because sometimes, like you said before, these guys, they've got their families and whatnot, and, you know, one thing we've talked about is they're citizen firemen. You know, these guys, they're professionals of the sense on the job, but they're not career. They're not career men, and this is not what they're doing to make their living. And oftentimes, for those of you who are listening who may not be familiar with these kind of departments, you know, sometimes you'll see how, oh, well, they're not serious about firefighting. They just want to stay outside. It's not so much that. It's they have a lot that they think of. This stuff doesn't get instilled in them that you're making a paycheck to put your life on the line for somebody else. Oftentimes, they look at it as, I'm going to do whatever I can to help you, but if I get hurt, nobody's going to be paying my bills, family. I don't have a fire department that will be taking care of them. I don't have a union that's going to be there for me. You know, it's you're volunteering your time and you're really putting your family at risk is the mindset that comes across here. Now, is that a bad mindset? Well, that's debatable, you know, and I mean, we can get into this on later topics, but you know, it's definitely a different breed, and I think that's why, you know, a lot of paid departments will be like, okay, here's your set standards. You've got 6 weeks to get your training in, and then if not, you're off the department. And I just, you know, like I've said before, I just don't think you can do that with the departments that, like, you and me see on a regular basis. You know, what are your thoughts, Mark?
I agree completely, and it's good to know that we're not operating outside of the norm, and that was kind of why I threw the question out there. We do everything on a case basis. There's no real stringent guidelines on that as far as getting your 20 hours. The ones that I like to see are the ones who are down there after they get off work, if they work just learning how to put their gear on and off, donning and doffing in 2 minutes. You don't have to have a structured class for that. The guys who are down there looking at the equipment and making sure that they know where every piece of equipment is on every truck, so that if an officer calls for it, they may not be able to make an interior attack yet, but they can at least provide service on the scene and learn. And those are the ones that you really try to cultivate. But I don't think we try very hard not to penalize the ones in Western Kentucky who have jobs and they do have families to provide for. They have other obligations. And like it or not, we are taking food off our table and gas out of our cars and everything else in order to do this service as volunteers. And so I think that flexibility, compassion, and a little common sense all need to go into those decisions, keeping firefighters, cultivating them, because we may train a guy over a year, 6 months. He's not able to provide a whole lot of service at that time, but his situation may change, and he may grow into one of the best firefighters we have. But if we alienate him early in the system by trying to push him too hard to do what we want, I think we do the entire service a disservice, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, and you know, there's definitely tricks, and you know, and I think it's one of those things where there's good officers that are career officers, and there's good volunteer officers, and a career officer to me, you know, that's what these guys' job is. You know, if they don't do it, that's their paycheck. You can tell them to hit the road. When you take a volunteer fire officer, though, he's got to be more of a balancing act and a politician. And so, I mean, because he can have a gung-ho kid, and then he can have a slouch. And the slouch can be one who doesn't, well, for lack of better words, he doesn't give a shit other than about his red light and sirens and his badge. And, you know, it's, so you've got to balance, because if you make either one mad, you're down a dude. So if you're down a dude, you know, yes, he's a slouch, but he can get a tanker out. And so that's a water supply issue. The kid, he's an aggressive fireman, and he's a good fireman, and he's a future fire officer and, line officer. You know, so it's a juggling act, and it's a balancing act, and I totally agree with you when, you know, a lot of these guys are not going to go and take the bread and stuff off their table. You know, they give up so much. They give up their family times and stuff. You know, they look and do that whatever they can to help these people. But in the long run, they also are thinking about their own families. And you know, they're truly, you know, the heroes from next door. But, you know, when we talk about the training topics and stuff, I think in a whole, you know, you got to find a way to get everybody making the trainings. And you got to find a way to get them to come to these trainings. You know, in that sense, I think it does help to have some mandatory. You know, for instance, I totally believe that the, you know, like driver's training and stuff, it needs to be made mandatory. But, you know, how do you guys do that stuff down there as far as, you know, a mandatory training? Because here you are, it's still volunteers. So how do you mandate a certain style of training? Or do we mandate it to where it's a training that you have to have once a year at your own discretion on when you get it or where you get it for that fact?
Okay, I tell you what. First off, I'm going to go ahead, if you've got just a minute, and I am going to say thank you to Granger and put on a little bit of publicity for them real quick, and I will come back and we'll cover driver's training as soon as I get back.
Awesome.
With over 100,000 safety products, it makes me wonder, did Granger write the book on workplace safety? Get your copy today. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Granger.com, or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Awesome.
On driver training. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I sit there and I listen to that Granger ad, and I just, you know, we're truly blessed by Granger to get this opportunity to sit here and talk the way we are. I mean, they really do great things for helping us out with that. And, you know, and I want to just say thank you to Pinwell again for allowing us to sit here and chat about this rural and suburban issues that we all encountered here. So, but go ahead, Mark.
Well, before we go any further, we are running close on time tonight. And once we get the next segment scheduled, and hopefully all four of us at least will be back next on the next scheduled broadcast, and I'm going to ask for the input from the community. Guys, please feel free to call in, ask questions, feel free to call in and give us your perspective on the things that we're throwing out here. We're not trying to sell our ideas to you. What we're trying to do is throw enough information out here to stir up a conversation and then find a better way to do it so that we can all advance, so that we can all be safe, so that we can all go home to our families. And it doesn't matter if it's driver's training or if it's fire behavior. One of the things that I stress in every class, and I think I've probably said it 100,000 times, is in the fire service we really only have one job. And that is, if you leave the station with 12 people, by God, you come back with 12 people. And one of the things that I really want to have is some more input from the community. So feel free next time to call in and bring those thoughts, ideas, disagreements. I'm wrong 1,000 times a day, and I will admit it every time. Bring those thoughts to us. Let us know what you're thinking, good or bad. And let's discuss them. We can all learn from them. Now, back on the driver's training, I know we're required to have the 20 hours driver's training. The curriculum was developed about 13 years ago and has not really been revamped since original inception. It is probably one of the better curriculums nationally that I have seen as far as a good fundamental base. It starts with the 4 hours of classroom and then has the cone course. But I have never known a cone course to sue anyone. I've never known a cone that got run over and took me to court. I think that it's a really good idea for those particular hours to be done annually, and I think it's a really good idea for those particular hours to be done by someone outside your department who can actually step on a lot of toes and then go home. So I personally recommend that a state instructor or someone from a neighboring department come in and tell you the truth about the law, tell you the truth about the consequences, tell you the truth about the expectations, tell you the truth about past experiences, things that we've had. There have been multiple fire accidents in Kentucky. Use some of those in your training. However, in an 8-hour course, the average student can fool the instructor and seem like a relatively normal human being for that 8 hours. But the officer in the department is the front line in defense, and he is also the one responsible for the legal obligations and everything else. So I personally believe that every class that I've ever taught driver's training, whether it's at a regional school or a local fire department, I think that that should suffice for a section of the hours required. But I think that an officer who is actually familiar with the individual doing the on-the-road four left turns, four right turns, coming up to a railroad track and stopping, making sure he obeys all the stoplights, and going through that checklist that we have in the state of Kentucky, it needs to be someone who knows the demeanor, someone who knows the personality, the maturity, the excitability, the attitude of the individual driving, because he's the one who's ultimately going to sign off on that. He's also going to take the responsibility if there's a problem later. So I think that that needs to be done in-house, and I think that it needs to be done at least annually. I think that a good portion of what we do can be assessed without a class by simple observation fire scene. If you see a guy who's driving erratically, too wildly, getting too excited, I have no problem with an officer at that department saying, okay, we need to retrain you, or we need to talk, we need to figure out, because right now you're not driving the truck in a way that's responsible. Now, that also brings up another issue that I'm super important in Kentucky as a whole, and that goes back to equipping your red light or your personal vehicle with red lights and siren. KRS does allow us to do that. Kentucky Revised Statute does allow us to do that with written permission from the fire chief in our local department to basically equip our emergency vehicles as our personal vehicles as emergency vehicles. And that takes on a whole new area of responsibility both for the department and then for the state. So I think that that needs to be handled on a very, shall we say, short leash type of thought process from the chief to ensure that we continue to develop a good relationship with the community, a good responsible driving record with the community, and we're not seen as those idiots who blow down the road at 100 miles an hour in a $9 car, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and that brings up a good point because, you know, as far as training, you know, how many times do you really ever see a driver's training program centered around POVs? I mean, you know, the last state fire training class that I had on the driver's training for our department, you know, it was on, you know, tankers. You know, and we focused mostly on tankers, and which is, you know, one of our bread and butter trucks, you know, that we have in our, you know, area, and especially in the rural and, you know, suburban areas. And so, you know, but we often overlook those POVs. And when you start looking at NIOSH reports at the amount of people who end up dying due to POV accidents, you know, I mean, when you look at the speeds and the factors that are played into it, it's like, you know, how do, you know, we're missing out here, you know. So, something's not working right. And, you know, and I've heard some that are like, well, we don't even issue light and siren permits in our state. You know, I've heard that from some. And, you know, and then I hear some that say how, well, it gets you there quicker. You know, to me, I mean, do you think, let me ask you, Mark, do you feel like we need to just outlaw them altogether? Or do you feel like I do, let's revamp our driver's training programs to include POV training, you know, not driving 100 miles an hour. You know, you're not in, you know, the Daytona 500. You know, you got to get there safe, because if you don't get there safe to the station to get the truck, then how are you going to do that person any good? You know what I mean? I mean, what are your thoughts on the whole light and siren permit within the state and or just in general throughout America?
Well, first off, I'd like to keep as much as I can regulation-wise within the local jurisdiction and within the local department. I think it makes a great deal more sense for us to govern ourselves than to have the state govern it for us. So when I was working in law enforcement, I would take a common sense approach, and if I saw somebody who was driving let's just use the words without due regard, and we'll go from there. Let's say he was driving his POV without due regard. My first response would be to follow him to the scene, if he's not endangering the life of himself or someone else, to allow him to do that. Now, generally, when my vehicle got in behind him, he would slow down considerably in most cases and start driving with a little common sense. But when I would wait for the immediately dangerous to life health situation to be over, and then I would talk to the chief or incident commander of the scene, and I would say, this is your one time. Either you handle it or I will. And I like to keep things at that level, because generally they're going to be more scared of getting dismissed from the department or getting their light and siren card pulled than they would anything that I, law enforcement in this state, was going to be able to do for them or to them. However, there are situations where I know at this time the curriculum chair in the state of Kentucky is revamping a lot of the curriculums. We do have a full-time curriculum developer at this point. He is excellent, outstanding at what he does, probably the best I've ever seen. And I know that he is going to be updating and modernizing a lot of the curriculums for the Kentucky Fire Commission that are being taught in the state of Kentucky. I think it's overdue, but I'm not knocking it. I'm just proud that we have that available and happening now. I would like to see in that section more than the common sense approach that I've taken. I'd like to see some, I don't want to say stringent regulations, but some more training on POVs and operating of POVs. And I hate to say this, but one of the things in my driver's training classes that I teach is I'd rather see you fix the brakes. I'd rather see you fix the put some tires on the car rather than spend that $1,000 on lights and siren. Because
Amen.
If you're ever involved in an accident in the state of Kentucky and you hurt or kill someone while responding to a personal vehicle with lights and siren, one of the first things that they're going to do is impound the vehicle, and they're going to check and see where the fluid's right, what's the drag coefficient of the tires on the surface that you were running on, what's the brake depth or the depth of your brake pads. They're going to check and, you know, take the bulbs out of the rear of the vehicle and check for heat shock on those and see if they were operating, if you had your foot on the brake or the accelerator at the time of the accident. And not only is it the training, but I think it's going back to the responsibility of the departments at this time, and possibly if we can use some responsibility and continue using it in Kentucky, it won't have to be regulated on a state level that we put in place, the less firefighters we're going to have statewide. And I firmly believe that's nationally as well. The harder we make it for someone to volunteer their time, the fewer personnel we're going to have. And so for that reason, I think that it's extremely important that we self-regulate, that we get out and teach the individual newer people at the departments the responsibility that they have, the danger that they're in, and then if they do something stupid, the danger that they're presenting in the public, and ensure that we use a very common sense approach to that.
Awesome. Yeah, I totally agree with you there. And, you know, and that just, that brings us up for more topics in the future, but looks like we're running a little shy on time here. And so with that, I everybody out there, I want you all to take care. Have a good night, safe night for everybody on duty. Take care. Thanks for Julio for calling in. And from here in the Bluegrass, this is Chris, and take care and God bless.
And this is Mark. I'll be signing off. I would like to give Granger one more 30-second blurb here, so you guys stay tuned, and we'd love to hear from you again next time.
When we put out fires, it ain't the metaphor kind, kid. That's why I use Granger. They got everything. They got Bullard helmets, Cosmos boots, Elkhart brass nozzles, and on top of it all, Granger's got the inventory management solutions to keep the heat off the books. Heck, they've got just about everything you need for the fire station except the trucks. When you think fire rescue, you think Granger. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Granger.com/public safety, or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.